You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how much money Foxconn has given to UW-Madison 2 years into a five-year agreement. First, Hurricane Isaias hit the East Coast earlier this month, and on the West Coast, the Apple Fire burned in California. That comes as the nation is battling a new virus that's caused a global pandemic. And because of climate change, overlapping disasters like these may become more common. Our next guest has been reporting on how we can prepare for and recover from these simultaneous crises. Christopher Flavelle is a reporter with the New York Times. He covers how people, governments, and industries are trying to cope with the effects of climate change. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, talk about, first of all, this year's hurricane season. That's one thread in this story. It's been record-breaking in some ways, right?
Yeah, it's been record-breaking in terms of the number of storms and the speed with which we've gotten to X number of storms. There hasn't been, thank God, there hasn't yet been the kind of really severe storm that sort of shook FEMA and shook parts of the country in 2017 and 2018. I'm worried that I'll jinx it by saying that. But so far, it's been marked more by a series of many sort of small to medium scale storms. But I think what's worrisome is, as you just noted, it's never just one, right? It's either a storm or a fire or both or a derecho. And it's the sort of the accumulation of those events that's causing all these problems.
Yeah, that's the concern that you write about, that with climate change, each of those individual kinds of disaster, the storms or droughts or fires or hurricanes, become more likely. And that raises the risk of dealing with one or two and throwing a pandemic too, one or two or three things at the same time. Can you talk about what we're seeing in terms of these odds getting stacked against us?
Yeah, no, it's the problem isn't so much, as you know, it's not just any individual event. The problem is, if you've got a local emergency management office or even a county or even a state that can handle one of these events 5 years ago, 10 years ago, they might have been fine, right? You can get through a year with the money you have and the staff you have, and it's going to be okay. The issue is, if your staff start to get worn down and you start to say, oh, we need more help, and you go to other neighboring jurisdictions, you say, send your firefighters, send your emergency managers, send your public health officials, because we are swamped. The problem is, if the next county over is swamped and the next state is swamped and the federal government is swamped, all of a sudden you've got a capacity problem, right? Which sounds like a dry way of putting it, but people who need help can't always get it in this kind of situation. And I think the federal government and local officials I talked to all have the same concern. And that's what happens if we get walloped by a few big disasters all at the same time again, and there's not enough help to go around. And we haven't really had to deal with that yet. And it's one of those problems that is presented by climate change, and there isn't really a good answer.
Let's turn to that federal level now. You write some about FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Are they getting stretched then?
Yeah, unquestionably. And FEMA will say, you know, we've done a good job staffing up. We can a good job sort of being as ready as we can. And I'm not aware of any sort of clear examples of FEMA dropping the ball this year. But I think as hard as they try to sort of build up their reserves of staff and pace everything well, they are still facing a mission that they were just not designed for, which is to deal with this many disasters all around the country at the same time, on top of COVID, which, as they will tell you, is the first 50-state disaster they've had to deal with. So it's a mission that is hard in the best of times with the best people. And the problem with climate change is it's going to get worse. And I think it raises a real question about whether this model of having an agency that has only a few thousand people is enough to handle these kinds of disasters.
We're talking to Christopher Flavelle from the New York Times, talking about climate change raising the risk of having not just one disaster, but multiple disasters going on at the same time, and the stress that puts on our emergency management and response at the federal, state, and local levels. Is anybody, Christopher, talking about a new model, a change in the way we think about our risks and try to manage them?
Yeah, look, I don't want to sound overly defeatist here. There are definitely things you can do, but they tend to be pretty sweeping changes. Brock Long, who used to run FEMA and ran FEMA through the really severe years of 17, 18, and 19, his whole push, and I've heard him say this to me a few times, is in general, communities that are vulnerable to storms, which is most of them, tend to probably rely too heavily on this idea that if they build in a vulnerable place or if they build homes that aren't really, really resilient and something bad happens, someone's going to come by and bail them out. And his point, and others make the same point, is you might at some point have to change that mindset and say maybe we shouldn't build near rivers. Maybe we should build homes that are going to better withstand hurricanes or floods. Maybe people should have more insurance so they can handle the damage if their homes get hurt. And this idea that you have to put meaningful constraints on where and how you build homes, that's been a really tough message for a lot of reasons. People don't want to be told not to build somewhere. But I think as this cost grows and the disasters increase, that argument becomes harder to ignore. And so one of the things I'm watching is, will the increase in disasters change the way American communities look and where people build homes, because there might be too many disasters to recover from?
Another point you raise is that a consistent theme, whether we're talking about COVID-19 or who gets hit the worst by our hurricane, it's not the same for everybody. Some people, lower income people, more at risk. People of color, black people in particular, more at risk. Can you talk about how these things don't hit everybody equally?
Absolutely. It's a huge problem. One of the things that we know from experience, and it makes sense intuitively, is that you've got lots of communities around the country that are just naturally more exposed to disasters. They could be built on lower-lying land that is harder to protect. They could be homes that aren't as expensive, so weren't built to the same standards. Often those are communities of color. Often they're low-income communities. And then when you get a disaster, all of a sudden those communities are really dependent on federal or state or local aid. If there isn't enough aid to go around, which is not a stretch these days, or if that aid is not enough to rebuild, you are left sort of to your own devices, right? And I think what we're seeing is communities that don't really have the wealth to begin with to rebuild are then left to compete for an increasingly stretched amount of money. And the problem is they don't really have a great backup. So I think one of the inequities in this country that's getting harder to ignore is the inequitable exposure to natural hazards, and climate change is making that worse.
Another thing that hits me as you're talking, you know, if I was a local government leader thinking, wow, gosh, it sounds like I need to invest more in, you know, getting ready for a disaster like this, hearing that at a time like now with COVID, with the economic downturn, all those units of local government are taking an economic hit. That's another source of, I guess, stress on the system, right?
Yeah, you know, it's a real issue right now, and one that I'm watching and other reporters are watching. A lot of the spending projects at the state and local level to protect people from disasters, you know, flood walls, better drainage system, better stormwater management, those tend to be expensive. Those are big ticket infrastructure items, and those tend to be the ones that get canceled or shelved when money is tight. So I think there's a real risk that the downturn from the pandemic will really set back this this long-term push to make people and communities more resilient to storms. And the problem with that is it's not clear to me how long that downturn might last. No one knows. And so you could have, in theory, years where you lose that kind of investment, and the result is even as storms get worse, people's protections against them also get worse. It's a real bad mix.
Any kind of silver lining you can lead us with, Christopher, that you know, people are at least waking up to the problems you're raising?
You know, one thing I hear from people is that there's a benefit to raising awareness, that as more homeowners and potential homeowners hear that this is an issue, they'll think harder about what they can do. Maybe they'll look harder at what kind of insurance they have. They'll think about getting flood insurance. They'll think about, you know, increasing the flood protection on their home. They'll look more carefully at where they buy a home. And probably that's what it comes down to, especially as governments have to pull back a bit. you probably are putting more weight on individual decisions. So, yeah, the silver lining probably is at some point all the stuff in the news makes people think, what is my exposure and what can I do? Probably that's a good thing. The concern is that probably won't go far enough. There's some problems that are too big for individual homeowners to deal with. But certainly more attention and more awareness probably is going to help.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Christopher Flavelle reports on how people, governments, and industries are trying to cope with changes brought on by global warming and the risks of overlapping disasters in the midst of climate change. Coming up, Foxconn pledged $100 million to UW-Madison 2 years ago. We'll find out how much of that has come in and whether they're likely to make good on that pledge over time. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the political fight over the United States Postal Service is raising red flags for the November election. We'll talk to a Wisconsin member of Congress and a political scientist to learn more. Now, just a little over 2 years ago, then Foxconn CEO Terry Goh and UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank signed an agreement that was supposed to create a partnership for engineering research and innovation. While the actual signed agreement didn't have a dollar amount in it, the figure of $100 million was discussed and celebrated publicly. 2 years into that five-year agreement, UW-Madison has received only a small fraction of that amount. Kelly Meyerhofer is a higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, has been following this story from the start. Kelly, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Kelly, take us back to the early days of this Foxconn deal and this this outreach to UW-Madison and some other campuses, for that matter, of this money that was going to be sent from Foxconn to campuses.
Sure. So back in late August 2018, we're coming up on the two-year anniversary, UW-Madison and Foxconn held a big news conference on campus. And I remember that Bucky Badger was there. It was a very exciting atmosphere. People were really excited about this partnership that was hailed as the largest research partnership in the university's history. Foxconn pledged $100 million that would partially go to build a new engineering building on campus. And it would also allow for sort of a pipeline between some engineering and STEM students to work at the company's facilities in the Racine area. And then last year, I decided to follow up right around that one-year anniversary to see how much of that $100 million had been received so far. And I found through a public records request that the university had gotten $700,000. And now that we're coming up on the two-year anniversary, I followed up again with another request. And the latest figure is still $700,000, which indicates that the university didn't receive any money from Foxconn in this past year.
So that's less than 1% of that original pledge. How was there a time frame in mind in the original agreement of when this would all come in?
That's a good question. I mean, the agreement itself is in place for 5 years. I don't remember the exact language off the top of my head. They could potentially extend that. Right now it's just in place for 5 years.
Now, this $100 million amount, this is the amount that was said out loud. Was that actually enumerated in the signed agreement?
It was not. And the agreement wasn't provided. I remember asking, on the day that the $100 million announcement was made, I asked for a copy of the agreement, and they told me to file a records request, which they supplied a few days or weeks later. And the actual agreement does not include the $100 million. Instead, it's much more vague. It says that the company intends to make a substantial investment in research and other activities with UW-Madison.
So talking to either side of this, UW-Madison or Foxconn, is either party in this talking about whether more money is coming, how and when it might come through?
Yeah, I mean, what UW-Madison has told me is They've sort of deferred to Foxconn and said they're really in the best position to explain their plans, but they've indicated that the pandemic may have affected this most recent year. Also, last year, the company's founder, he stepped down to run for political office in Taiwan. And then a special assistant to that founder, who was sort of like the de facto leader in the Wisconsin project, he stepped down for personal reasons. So there's been a lot of changes in the company's leadership. There's also been the pandemic. So those are the two big explanations the university has offered, but they've also said that we have an open line of communication with them. And last year they said that they were hopeful that the partnership will continue. They didn't really indicate that in this most recent story, though.
Was there supposed to be a matching side of things? Foxconn was going to pony up some cash and UW-Madison was going to try to match those donations?
Yeah, that's how it was framed at the time back in August of 2018. And I've asked the university how much they've raised in matching funds. Last year, they said they hadn't really started that fundraising campaign because they were still sort of working with Foxconn. I asked that question again this year, and the university declined to answer.
Talking to Kelly Meyerhofer from the Wisconsin State Journal. She's been tracking a deal between UW-Madison and Foxconn to hit a pledge of $100 million from Foxconn to UW-Madison. $700,000 of that has been given so far. You also reported on another deal at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign that they made with Foxconn. What are the details of that? How did it compare to the Wisconsin deal?
Yeah, their partnership is a little more recent. It was announced last fall, and it wasn't Foxconn specifically, but it was this subsidiary of the company, sort of like a smaller part of the company, that announced they were going to give $50 million to the University of Illinois over a 10-year period. And this company subsidiary had worked with and partnered with the university before. And their agreement's a little different because it cites like a specific payment schedule in that they're going to give $1.25 million every quarter of the calendar to the university. So by my calculation, about three calendar quarters have passed since last fall. So that would be $3.75 million of the $50 million that they've received so far.
Now, getting back to the Wisconsin deal, as you mentioned, this was August of 2018. And I know, and I think you covered this in some of your reporting, some skeptics at the time said this was trying to drum up enthusiasm for the Foxconn deal. It was a election for governor that year, Governor Walker, a key player in the Foxconn deal. Was there some suspicion of that at the time?
Yeah, there was definitely suspicion, you know, particularly from Democrats who have had a lot of skepticism about the company and their projects, you know, across the globe. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely been skepticism. You know, how this pledge to the university has played out has really only fueled that from those critics.
So what are you watching for to see if the rest of this pledge will be met over the next, I guess, 3 years of this deal?
I mean, I guess I just plan to follow up every August for the next 3 years to see if, you know, if the company kicks in any additional money. I think it's important to follow up. If they were to give a substantial amount, I imagine there would be some sort of press release coming out. But, you know, in the absence of that, I'll just continue to submit records requests and follow up every year to see.
Now, you reported on something I hadn't heard about, a group of UW-Madison graduate students, a group called the Fox Hounds, protesting the partnership. Could you tell that story?
Yeah, so this is a group, mostly graduate students. They formed shortly after the $100 million announcement and university partnership came out. They sort of fall on the Democratic side of the political debate involving Foxconn, and they think it's just way too cozy of a relationship for a public university to have with a private company that has received a fair amount of criticism for its labor and environmental practices. So this group formed, they've pushed back against the university, they've submitted their own records requests, they distributed like anti-Foxconn flyers at a career fair where Foxconn was trying to recruit students. And then at a Board of Regents meeting a couple years back, they dropped some like banners that were anti-Foxconn. But they've been relatively silent over the past academic year. And I don't know if that's just because there's not that much to protest given how little the university has received from the company so far.
I want to switch gears for our last minute, Kelly. I know another story you're watching closely is the return to campus. This is a big deal around the country. You've been watching UW-Madison. What's the big story there right now?
I mean, the big story is just like how reopening will work. The university hasn't really given any indication that they're going to be backing away from this. Freshmen are moving into the residence halls next week. A few hundred of them actually moved in over the weekend. Those that live close by, they have sort of like an early move in. So I think what everyone's really watching is how, when, you know, the full student body is back and there's students in residence halls and some are going to classes that are going to be held online, can the university contain outbreaks and, you know, in a way that so they can keep campus opening, or will they be like what's just happened at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where 2 weeks after move-in, they just announced yesterday that they have to pivot to all online instruction and they're sending students home because there were just so many COVID cases on campus.
You've got a lot on your plate to watch, Kelly. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate it.
Kelly Meyerhofer is a higher education reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. She's been following the story of Foxconn's $100 million pledge to UW-Madison since it was made 2 years ago. To date, UW has received only $700,000. Join us tonight at 8 for live NPR coverage of the Democratic National Convention from Milwaukee. A mix of live and virtual events is planned as delegates contend with the COVID-19 pandemic and work to nominate their party's candidates for president and vice president. That's tonight through Thursday night, starting at 8 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin congressional representative about what's happening with the U.S. Postal Service and what it could mean for the November election. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent welcomes a financial planner with advice and answers to your personal finance questions. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy announced today that the Postal Service would temporarily halt plans already underway that have been criticized for potentially undermining the November election. More voters than ever have relied on the Postal Service for absentee ballots because of the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak. But recent changes, like the removal of some mailboxes and high-speed sorting equipment, have some lawmakers on Capitol Hill crying foul. Coming up, we'll talk to a political scientist about how the political fight over the USPS could impact voters over the next 80 days. First, a member of Wisconsin's congressional delegation joins the show. Representative Mark Pocan is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Dane County. Representative Pocan, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I want to start you off with the latest news. We heard from the Postmaster General saying, hey, we're going to put a hold on these changes. I'm going to quote at some length here. There are some longstanding operational initiatives, efforts that predate my arrival at the Postal Service that have been raised as areas of concern as the nation prepares to hold an election in the midst of a devastating pandemic. To avoid even the appearance of any impact on election mail, I am suspending these initiatives until after the election is concluded. End quote there. What are your thoughts on that announcement today?
Well, you know, talk is cheap. Actions are different. We know that they've done a number of measures. One thing that you didn't mention in the intro comments is overtime pay. And that wasn't something done before he got there. That's something he chose to quit doing overtime pay, which was then causing delays in mail, significant delays in mail, in addition to the removal of mailboxes and the dismantling of sorting equipment. So there's a lot that we still have to do to, one, make sure that it has really stopped. Two, how much damage has already been done? What do we need maybe to put back together again? And that's why Congress is going to be voting on Saturday on legislation to do just that, as well as get the Postal Service the $25 billion that their Board of Governors, appointed by Donald Trump, has requested from Congress.
Wisconsin has joined a lawsuit, now one of 20 states suing the Postal Service to tackle these recent changes. What are you hoping comes out of that that lawsuit from 20 states?
Well, I think the lawsuit is also trying to, you know, get us back to having a effectively run post office. The problem is sometimes legal actions can take a while. So that's why we're doing everything we can, whether it be legislative action, whether it be those individual lawsuits, to make sure that people are aware of what's going on. You know, it's not just about Donald Trump trying to create chaos around the election. This affects seniors and veterans who get their medicines via the U.S. mail. This affects small businesses that are already hurting because of COVID-19 in getting packages out and getting goods in via U.S. mail. This hurts people who are largely home these days in many cases, and that's their only way of really getting contact with the outside world. So yeah, there's a lot of other ramifications more than Donald Trump just trying to confuse people whether or not their ballot will count. We are trying to make sure people understand that you can request your ballot now. You can immediately fill it out when you get it. You don't have to wait till the Friday before the election, because guess what? The candidates aren't changing on the ballot. And then you can, if you want, drop it right in the mail with 6 weeks to spare, or you can drop it off at your city hall, village hall, town hall, and it will be counted. Donald Trump will not win in his chaos that he's trying to create.
Yeah, can you talk about what you view as President Trump's motivations in, first of all, claiming that absentee ballots, that mail-in voting is more subject to fraud, and his efforts to limit access to mail-in voting?
Well, I mean, it's ridiculous. He and his whole family has always requested absentee ballots. There is no difference between mail-in voting and absentee voting. It's the identical same thing. It's like saying somehow six oranges weigh a lot more than a half a dozen. It's illogical. It's kind of idiotic. But it's what Donald Trump is trying to put out there. It's his spin. The reality is many states just do mail-in voting, and it works really well. Oregon, for example, is one of the highest turnouts in the nation with virtually no fraud, and they're doing this very well, and other communities have done this well. So Donald Trump, again, is just trying to make it confusing so people maybe won't get a mail ballot. Maybe they won't show up Election Day, because who knows what will be happening by Election Day with COVID. And he wants to pick voters rather than voters picking the next president. And I think it's backfired for him because of all the other ramifications. And people should know, as long as they request their ballot and vote early, not often, but early, you will have your ballot counted.
The Postmaster General is scheduled to testify in front of a House committee. What are you hoping to hear from him?
Well, just exactly what the timeline was of some of these changes. Like I said, the overtime clearly did not come out of any previous decisions. He's made those decisions, so he hasn't been completely forthright. I for one, have called for his removal. You know, he also has conflicts of interest, financial conflicts of interest with competing entities to the Postal Service, and he's the Postmaster General. That doesn't make any sense to me. So we really need to know more about that. We need to know more about what he did. We want to know about how he's going to fix the things that in the last several weeks he did in taking machines apart. There's a lot of questions we still have.
Representative Pocan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you.
Mark Pocan represents Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Madison. He joins today to talk about what's happening at the U.S. Postal Service. We continue the conversation about the political fight over the Postal Service now and how voters could be impacted. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Have you been affected by slowdowns in mail lately? Are you counting on voting by mail for the first time or the 20th time in this November election? Join in at 800-642-1234. Philip Chen joins us now, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Always happy to be here, Rob.
What do you make of this kind of a political dispute over the U.S. Postal Service, given the importance of absentee ballots? This is not something I think anybody would have necessarily predicted coming into 2020.
Yeah, I mean, again, like you said, it's 2020 is a year that has thrown a lot of things at us to try to understand. I would say that the big thing to take away from it is the level of trust that people have in the process of voting, and that whether or not the Postal Service enacts these changes. It seems like they're the Postmaster General is going to put a halt on the sort of operational changes. Whether or not that happens, it's about how much trust people have that their ballot is going to be counted correctly and going to be delivered to them and delivered back to their precinct in the state in time.
Can you talk about how important mail-in voting is going to be from what we know so far in this November election?
Honestly, I think what we know is actually very little. We don't know exactly how much, how many people are going to request this. We know that overall in the country, in the primaries, after the pandemic hit, we saw increases in vote by mail and absentee ballot requests. You know, my gut instinct says it's going to be a major issue for how people decide to vote. But we still have people who very much think that they need to vote in person, that they trust that process more than the absentee process. Do I think we're going to see higher levels of absentee voting or vote by mail? Absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt about that. The question, of course, is how will it happen? Will there be trust in that process? And then how will the counting happen? How will that affect results, things like that?
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jake is with us in Wausau. Jake, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you want to bring up, Jake?
So I just want to bring up that I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there is possibly some differences between the absentee ballots versus the mail-in ballots in the form of verification. And also, you know, to say that there's no fraud that exists within mail-in, there's definitely cases that have existed. I think there was in Brooklyn or something like that where 80,000 ballots were rejected based on their verification process. So,
Jake, thanks for the call. So first of all, Jake's saying there is a significant difference between absentee and mail-in when it comes to verification, Phil?
There's actually no difference in the state. And in fact, I don't believe any state has a difference on that. In Wisconsin, for instance, you have to absentee ballot versus mail-in ballot, they're the same word, as Representative Pocan said, or they're different words for the same thing. There's one process, you request it, you have to submit a photo identification or a copy of your photo ID, just like you would when you go to vote in person, and then you get the ballot mailed to you. So there's no difference between mail-in ballots versus absentee ballots. It depends on the state as to what the requirements are. Wisconsin does not require any kind of reasoning for your absentee ballot. You can simply request one. Other states, for instance, might require you to verify that you are going to be absent from the precinct or from your home on that day. Most of those are just sort of testify that you're going to be absent. So it depends. There's a little bit of a state by state difference, but there are not sort of differences between absentee versus mail-in ballots as far as Wisconsin's process goes. They're just one form, one process for that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jake. I wanted to get to that, the invalidated ballots in Brooklyn. As I understand it, anyway, some people responded to that like Jake did and said, hey, a lot of people are trying to vote illegally by mail. Other people saying, we've got a poorly designed system that's leading to a lot of verifiable ballots never getting counted. What is your read on that, Phil?
So my read on that is that we're probably, what you're seeing with those 80,000 is inaccurate signatures, not matching signatures, inaccurate verifications, witnesses, things like that. In many cases, I mean, there's a difference between an invalidated ballot and a fraudulent ballot. We have had numerous studies done to examine incidents of fraud. And there's basically very few instances of fraud, either in person or by mail. That doesn't mean there aren't spoiled ballots. Ballots come in without the correct signatures on them, that are not filled out correctly, that have arrived in a different manner. And that doesn't necessarily indicate fraud. In fact, it usually indicates a system that's too complex for the average person to sort it out. And so if you don't have a witness signature on your ballot may be rejected. That doesn't mean that you filled it out fraudulently. It means that you filled it out inaccurately, or you completed the process inaccurately. And so in many cases, what we're actually seeing is probably more ballots being rejected than people who are, I mean, we definitely know more ballots are rejected than people who are committing fraud, because instances of fraud are, you know, according to the Brennan Center, somewhere around 0.0003%. We're just talking minuscule amounts of verifiable fraud. But we have plenty of ballots that are spoiled, that are rejected for various reasons that have nothing to do with fraud.
We're talking to Phil Chen, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College, about the ongoing fight over the U.S. Postal Service and how it could impact the 2020 general election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on what's happening at the Postal Service? What do you think about the Postmaster General's announcement today saying that the agency will stop the changes that had people concerned? If you work for the Postal Service, what changes have you noticed on the job? And if you commonly receive mail, is it slowing down lately? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the U.S. Postal Service and the November elections. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy announced today that the sweeping changes underway at the Postal Service would be temporarily paused in order to avoid issues with the November election. Philip Chen stays with us, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts on mail-in voting, what you're seeing at the national level with the U.S. Postal Service, what you're seeing maybe with your own mail delivery, and are you planning to vote by mail in November? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Sheila is with us in Oshkosh. Sheila, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm a resident of Winnebago County, and I've routinely voted absentee in the past. This spring, I requested an absentee ballot, but I'm one of the over 2,000 people that never received their ballot. I don't think I'll be voting absentee ever again.
Sheila, thanks for the call. As Sheila said, she was not alone there. I think people were swamped with requests for absentee ballots as the COVID-19 outbreak came about. Phil, do you see effort coming at the federal level to make sure the Postal Service can keep up with a possible demand for absentee ballots?
So I don't think that we've seen anything specifically from the Postal Service at the federal level. We've seen that the Democrats in the House have proposed bills to increase funding for the Postal Service with the intention that that funding is sort of one-time funding in order to meet the demands of a mail-in, of an election that is going to be run far more through the mail. The other thing to remember is that that delays or failing to get an absentee ballot could be the result of the Postal Service, but it could also be the result of, especially early on in the primary, it could have been the result of counties or election officials simply being unprepared with good reason. I mean, there was an idea that maybe the pandemic was going to lead to an increase in requests for absentee ballots, but it came very quickly for a lot of these election officials to have enough ballots printed and enough staff on hand to produce and to mail out those ballots. So, you know, there's lots of ways that ballots may not be delivered, be it the Postal Service or from, you know, early on in the pandemic, from election officials being unprepared for the volume, simply.
Sheila, thanks for that call. We'll go to Julie now in Watertown. Julie, hello.
Hi there. I have a question about duplicate votes. So if everybody gets a mail-in ballot, help me understand how I can't mail in my ballot and then go to the polls and vote and not have it count twice.
Right. They have a pretty solid system on that, Phil. When you vote in person or when they get the mail out, they check it off on the same list, right, Phil?
Exactly, right. So there's a centralized list for everyone who has requested their ballot. So there's a centralized list. It's printed off when you request it. It comes through the voter rolls. When you show up, if you were to have requested a ballot and you show up on election day and you try to vote again, it's going to say you've already requested your absentee ballot. Now, there is one sort of exception there, which is that you can, if you, for instance, request your absentee ballot and you say, you know what, I forgot to do this, I forgot to mail it in, you can show up on election day and you can certify that you have not submitted your ballot. That being said, these lists are very well integrated. They're the same list. So if you do that and you vote twice, it's not even difficult for the state to prosecute voter fraud. So the thing that keeps people from doing that is the threat of fines and jail time. It's the threat of breaking the law. And it is very, very simple in those kinds of cases. Duplicate voting is very simple for the state to track because it's a centralized single list.
Thanks a lot for that call. Julie at 800-642-1234, talking to Phil Chen from Beloit College about the U.S. Postal Service and mail-in voting. Back to your calls now. Robert is with us in Milwaukee. Robert, hello.
Hi there. I was just wondering, for those states that do require a reason to vote absentee, what's the likelihood that nationwide COVID-19 will be added to that list?
Thanks for the call, Robert. Interesting question. That's not an issue here in Wisconsin, if I have it right, Phil. Anybody can request. It's been a big issue, a court issue in other states, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a major issue as to sort of what meets that requirement. Many states have already added COVID-19 to their list of reasons that you can be absent from or you can vote absentee. It won't happen on the federal level because the federal government doesn't direct state or elections. Those rules are done at the state level. But the assumption is that most states that require this will do something to allow for people who don't feel safe at voting in person to vote in some other manner because of the pandemic. So the likelihood, I think, of somebody being told they have to vote in person despite feeling worried about the pandemic, it's going to happen, but it probably is a more minor issue than we might think, just because states are usually more willing to make those kinds of exceptions.
Thanks a lot for that call. Phil, I think in the past you've looked at the role of kind of local level bureaucrats and functionaries in making our elections work. Can you talk about the role that people play during elections in normal years / in 2020?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is something we refer to in political science as street level bureaucrats. And normally we talk about street level bureaucrats in voting when we're talking about things like voter ID and how there is a certain amount of discretion about who is asked for a voter ID, a photo ID at the polling places. And that's an area for bias to enter into the process. But in a year like this, we also have to think about street-level bureaucrats like your local mail carrier. Your local mail carrier has some discretion. Do they, you know, one of the big things, they may not be getting paid for overtime, but they have the discretion to work overtime and not get paid. They're probably not all going to do that, but there are lots of things that there's discretion at the level of your mail carriers. And so we can't always just think that top level decisions are the ones that automatically affect the people who are interacting with us day to day. Mail carriers see us every day. They see their neighborhood. They care about their neighborhoods. They care about the service they provide. For Morning Consult did a survey earlier this year looking at brands and found that across brands in the United States, not just government agencies, but across brands in general, the U.S. Postal Service was the number one trusted brand in the country. About 42% said there was significant trust in the USPS. Your everyday mail carriers don't want to abandon that trust. They know what builds that trust. And so there is some discretion at the individual level or at the street level for implementation as well. So it's while directives may come down from the top, there is more discretion that might happen at the neighborhood level.
Phil, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
Phil Chen is assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. He joined us today to talk about how the now paused changes at the U.S. Postal Service could impact voting in November. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a public health expert says there's some key COVID-19 data that isn't being shared with the public or researchers that's making it harder to get a handle on the disease. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, more and more police encounters are being recorded by citizens. That's had a big impact on the country in the George Floyd case and beyond. Kate talks to a criminal justice professor, and you can join him with your thoughts and questions. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then some young adults have moved back home with their parents in the last few months, and some older adults have moved in with adult children to help with childcare. We'll talk about multi-generational housing during the pandemic. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.